Coming up, John Gator in Orkney, some of the oldest inhabitants of North America, and a lost medieval abbey at the foot of a giant. Welcome to Time Team News, our new monthly feature bringing you all the latest archaeology stories and discoveries from Britain and across the globe. Well, we've got some great stories lined up for you this month, and once again we've been out and about in the field to catch some of the latest action firsthand. So this is our second instalment. Our first episode is available on YouTube now. And what a response. We're so glad that you like the format. Thank you so much for all your lovely comments and suggestions. Andy Gabriel Powell asked how you can volunteer for digs. Well, actually, we did a piece on this a while ago now, 5 ways to get involved in archaeology, giving you some ideas. And we'll share a link in the box below. Also, I would recommend having a look at the Council for British Archaeology's website. It lists all the regional groups that they've got, and you can contact them to find out if they've got any local volunteering opportunities available. Also, between the 8th and the 17th of September is Heritage Open Days in the UK. There are hundreds of venues open all across the UK. A lot of these are run by volunteers. So do have a look at the Heritage Open Days website to see what venues are open for you to visit near you. Right then, we've got a lot to cover this month, so let's get started. First up, we're off to Cerne Abbas, a village in Dorset in southwest England. Once described as Britain's most desirable village, it's most famous for its giant chalk figure carved into the hillside. Originally believed to be ancient, possibly prehistoric, recent research by the National Trust and Partners has established that this giant can't have been carved before 700 AD, making it late Anglo-Saxon, early medieval in date. Nevertheless, the area is steeped in history. Now, our story begins at the foot of the hill, where archaeologists from the University of Sheffield, led by Dr. Hugh Wilmot, have relocated the Benedictine Abbey that was lost during the dissolution of the monasteries under Henry VIII. The abbey itself has a fascinating history. It was built well before the Norman conquest and actually suffered a raid under King Canute in the early 11th century, before going on to become a major monastic complex. Lawrence has been out in the field to take a look.
Thank you, Danny. I'm here in Dorset and I popped out to meet Hugh. Talk us through what you're up to.
Well, we have stood on the walkway of the cloister. And we're excavating part of the cloister of the monastery and a little bit of the church as well.
So we're looking for a monastery and an abbey here.
Yes.
What drew you here in the first place?
Well, everyone knew there was an abbey here in the Middle Ages, but when it was closed down, it kind of disappeared off the map a bit. So its precise location wasn't known and quite what its sort of layout was. So last year we did a geophysical survey and got some amazing results. So we're now following that up with some excavation.
Fantastic. So we're on week 3. Why don't you talk us through what some of the things you found and some of the highlights?
Well, over in that part of the site, we've got the open cloister. It's like the sort of open garden area. And that linked up many of the main buildings of the Abbey complex. And then where we're stood at the moment is actually in the Abbey walkway, which was a covered walkway that ran around the outside of the garden and would have had an arcade with sort of open arches. Sometimes they were glazed so you could look out onto the garden. I mean, although it's been thoroughly demolished, there's all sorts of fragments of architecture and detail that help us, reconstruct its appearance. So we've got bits of moulded columns, we've got painted window glass, we've got the floor tiles. So, putting them all together, it gives us a really, really vivid impression of the building at its height.
Oh, look at that. That's spectacular.
Yep, this is an in-situ section of church floor.
So why don't you use that sponge and just tidy it up? I bet they cut really nicely.
Yeah, go on, give it a go. Oh.
Not done this before. I've never cleaned a medieval floor before. Oh, look at that. The colour's really coming up when you get that.
Absolutely.
Isn't that beautiful? Oh, this is really special.
It is. It's not often that you get to do that.
Hugh, we've got a great selection of the incredible masonry that you found in your trenches. The standout piece is this bit right in front of you here. What have we got?
Well, I'm not entirely sure what it is. I mean, it's from a fixture or fitting in the church. You know, it's not a sort of large monumental piece of architecture. If you imagine it the other way up, it looks like a sort of support or like a little shelf, perhaps for a statue or, you know, for something else to sit on in a very prominent location.
Fantastic. Well, here's hoping you find plenty more things like this.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Lawrence. We're following this excavation as it progresses, so please do look out for our extended coverage over on Patreon. While there's so much archaeology in the UK, amazing discoveries are being made all across the world. Ongoing research is helping to shed new light on ancient humans in what is now the state of Oregon in the Pacific Northwest of the United States. One of our Patreon members, Bill Erickson, says, "I'd love to see mention of the dig sites in Oregon and Idaho, extending back the time of humans in North America." Well, thank you, Bill, for that suggestion. Archaeologists from the University of Oregon have been excavating the site of a Rimrock Draw rock shelter near the city of Burns in Oregon since 2011, led by Dr. Patrick O'Grady. Now, because they're in the final stages of the fieldwork phase of the project, they haven't yet published the final results in an academic publication, but what they have done is produce some preliminary findings. Amongst many of the artefacts excavated at the site, there are ancient bison teeth, and there's also a tooth from a camelops, which is an extinct type of prehistoric camel that once roamed the area. And in the same area, there were two prehistoric worked tools, known as scrapers, made from orange agate. Now, archaeologists often talk about stratigraphy, which is the buildup of layers over time, representing different phases of activity. Now, what's interesting here is that the teeth and these two stone tools were recovered from underneath a layer of volcanic ash. Now, this volcanic ash came from one of the eruptions of Mount St. Helens, which occurred around 15,000 years ago. So that means that the teeth and the tools have to be older than 15,000 years because they were underneath this layer of volcanic ash, which is astounding. But what surprised the researchers even more is that since then, they've done radiocarbon dating on the bison teeth and on the camel tooth. And this has pushed the date of the site back even further to 18,250 years ago. Now, because of the presence of the tools at the site, this suggests that humans were present there all that time ago, around 18,000 years ago, making this potentially one of the earliest sites in North America. We look forward to hearing further developments on this research. It's always exciting following in the footsteps of our forebears, but thanks to discoveries in neighbouring Lake County, Oregon, we can actually trace their footwear too. Many sandals have been found at dry cave sites in Oregon's northern Great Basin in and around Fort Rock. The sandals have been expertly woven out of sagebrush bark and are incredibly well preserved. Many can be seen at Oregon's Museum of Natural and Cultural History, and some of the pairs have been radiocarbon dated and shown to be around 10,000 years old, making them the world's oldest footwear. Next up, a prehistoric complex on the outer reaches of the British Isles. The Ness of Brodgar is one of many ancient sites on Orkney, a cluster of islands off the northeast tip of Scotland. Orkney is a wild, rugged landscape, and it's home to some awe-inspiring archaeology. It was granted World Heritage Site status by UNESCO in 1999. Now, we've had quite a few requests about this one. For example, Katie Brown said, "Please talk about the Ness of Brodgar." Well, as it happens, Time Team's John Gator was there this summer. In fact, it's a site close to his heart because he discovered it some 20 years ago whilst undertaking a geophysical landscape survey across Orkney.
as we expanded the survey, I started to realise they weren't geological responses, they were actually archaeological responses, and something on a scale I think it's fair to say I'd never seen before.
What they discovered turned out to be a major Neolithic complex of international importance.
I've been doing archaeological geophysics for some nearly 50 years now, and I think I have to say discovering the Nessa Brodka has to be the main highlight of my career.
The site of the Nessa of Brodka stems back to the Neolithic, about 5,000 years ago. So it's broadly contemporary with Stonehenge. But never mind about Stonehenge, because Orkney has some of its own spectacularly impressive stone circles. The Ring of Brodka and the Stones of Stenness. Now, the Ness of Brodka lies almost equidistant between the two stone circles on a thin sliver of land between two lochs. The site shares some similarities with nearby Skara Brae, although the structures at the Ness of Brodka are larger and more complex. The excavations are run by the Ness of Brodka Trust in conjunction with the UHI Archaeology Institute, led by site director Nick Card. I love the sense of community that you get with this project, bringing together archaeologists and volunteers both locally and across the globe. Over the years, they've uncovered all sorts of interesting finds, including these highly polished carved stone balls, which are characteristic of the region. Intricately decorated examples of these stone balls have been found all across Orkney, but nobody really knows what they were used for. It remains a mystery at the moment, although there are lots of ideas. What do you think they were used for? Let us know in the comments section below. Other finds include polished stone axes, stone spatulas, painted masonry, and enigmatic engravings carved into stone. Visitors are welcome during the summer season, and 2024 is the last year of excavation before they start working on the post-excavation analysis and on publication. The project is mainly supported by the public, and you can get involved by having a look at the Ness of Brodka project webpage, and we'll put a link in below. And as John will attest, it's a project well worth supporting.
To see the results of Nick's 20 years' work at the site, I was overwhelmed. It was quite an emotional moment, something I'll never forget.
Last time, Derek visited Bournemouth University's Summer Field School, where students have been honing their skills on an Iron Age settlement as part of the Dura Tregays Big Dig.
The last 6 weeks, we've been excavating a large, what's known as a banjo enclosure. It's an elite farmstead, really existed about 300 to 100 BC. We've got storage pits everywhere. We've got roundhouses.
We're picking up on that story now, back in the lab with their colleagues, Harry Manley and Megan Russell, to discover what happens to all the finds.
We're here back at Bournemouth University, and I'm going to show you something we don't normally get to see on an excavation. It's a post-excavation process, and I'm joined by Megan, our processing manager, to talk us through what we get up to after the dig is finished. Hi, Megan.
Hi, Harry.
So what are we up to here then?
So this is where all of our finds come in, straight from the dig. So
there's quite a lot of them.
There is. We obviously aim to process all of our finds on site, but that, of course, is not realistic due to the sheer number of finds that we get. So this is where they all end up. We've got some nice, we've got a dog burial here. We've got a lot of samples that still need to be processed. Lots of pottery, lots of microfauna.
So this is washed and unwashed finds?
Yeah, almost all of this is completely unwashed, unrecorded, but we've got some nice stuff that has been washed. And over here, this is where the washed finds get processed and get recorded on the register.
Fantastic. I can see some nice pot here, some black burnishware with holes in the bottom. Is that usual or unusual?
Yes. So this is actually really typical of what we get. We have a lot of pot that has been fired and then has secondary drilled holes in the bases. So it wasn't their primary use, but actually then perhaps the rim has broken off. Whatever the primary use was for it, it is not useful anymore. So actually then they go, we use it for something else, like...
Recycling it.
Recycling, like a flower pot.
Yeah, fantastic. And what really strikes me, actually, is the sheer wealth of finds we're getting, because when I'm in the trench, you just see a snapshot of it. But when you're back here, it's like, God, right. We dug a lot.
Absolutely.
And what's Ruby doing over in the corner there?
So over here, Ruby is processing our microfauna. So this has been sieved at different levels, and she's just sorting through to pick out our really smallest bones.
From voles and frogs and toads.
Yeah, insectivores, hedgehogs, things like that. And these are really interesting to us because they can show us what has happened to the pit. So if it's been left open, things like frogs fallen in and then got stuck inside the pit. So it tells us that pit has been left open for a period of time, etc.
So we can get a really good understanding of the site as it develops and as it goes out of use.
Absolutely. So yeah, it definitely tells us about disuse.
Fantastic. Sure. So we've got a bit of a site history. And this over here, this is almost like a who's who or what's what of pots here, isn't it? This is incredible.
Yeah.
Such a good range of things going on. And oh, this is nice. This is nice. Tell us about this.
So this is our worked antler. And we're not sure about the use, but there, as you can see, there's lots of perforated holes and it's been sawn off. So it's obviously something. Yeah. We've never seen anything like this before.
This is amazing. I love all the cut marks on it as well. Mm. Not just the decoration on there. Fantastic. So is that antler, did you say?
It is, yes, antler.
Brilliant. I won't move too much because...
you can see me getting nervous.
Yeah, and also I'll put it back in the wrong tray. Well, thanks, Megan. We'll leave you and Ruby to get on with this. And hopefully we'll see Time Team back in Dorset soon.
Thank you both. It looks like you've got your work cut out for you there. So that's it for this month. Again, please do let us know any stories or discoveries that you'd like us to feature in the comments section below. 3D models for the stories that we've covered this month are available on Patreon, alongside other Q&As, masterclasses, and lots of other goodies. And if you'd like us to produce more excavations, help us to achieve our goal of 10,000 ongoing Patreon members. A very warm welcome to all our new Patreon members, and thank you to all members, old and new, that are helping us on our way to achieve that goal. So, thanks for watching. Please remember to subscribe, and I look forward to seeing you next time.
Join Time Team on Patreon to access exclusive 3D models, masterclasses, and behind-the-scenes insights.